Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm John Favreau.
I'm Dan Pfeiffer.
Here in studio.
The Crooked Media HQ.
Dan, this is your first time here.
It's amazing. It is amazing what you guys have built.
So we have Dan in studio. We also are going to talk to the former chief official White House photographer for Barack Obama, Pete Souza, also in studio. He's going to be here as well.
It's a party today. Nothing like an audio interview about a visual book.
We'll have some of that up on video at some point, by the way. We'll also be talking to the host of Crooked Media's with friends like these, Anna Marie Cox. Somehow she couldn't make it to LA. I don't know why. And also, we're going on tour again.
Back on the road.
We're going on tour this weekend, but we're also announcing a whole bunch of new cities for 2018. You'll be able to get tickets Friday morning, December 1st. We'll have more details on that. And some of the cities: Phoenix, Denver, Vegas, Houston, Austin, Dallas, San Antonio, Miami, Orlando, Clearwater, and New York. And there will be other cities that we're announcing in 2018 as the days go on. We can't announce them all today. But we'll start with those. So we're going to be busy in 2018.
What John is saying is that if your hometown is not on this list,
don't freak out.
Just chill.
Just wait.
Be patient.
Just be patient. Yeah. It's, you know, we're not on Twitter time here. Okay. Let's start with the Donor Relief Act of 2017, which is now speeding towards passage because, in fact, by the time you listen to it, the Senate may have voted for it. Yesterday, Wednesday, all 52 Republican senators voted to start debate on this bill, which is one of the most unpopular pieces of legislation they've ever considered. Just so everyone knows, by 2027, this bill will make sure that people earning more than $1 million a year get, in total, $5.8 billion in tax cuts. It's a lot of money for people who are millionaires. While 87 million families making under $200,000 would face a tax increase. So I guess my first question is, the bill is so incredibly unpopular. It is so incredibly tilted towards the wealthy, not just at the expense of the middle class, but by asking the middle class to pay more in their taxes, which is different than some of these other tax cut bills. So why are Republicans doing this? Why aren't some of our favorite moderates, quote-unquote moderates,
our heroes of the resistance,
why haven't they stepped up? Or even, like, you know, had any real concerns that would lead them to say they're maybe not voting for it?
Well, I was ranting about this to Hallie this morning, and she said to me, obviously this was going to pass. It was always going to pass for the same reason the conservative Democrats like Joe Manchin and others voted to pass the Affordable Care Act and give health care to people. Giving health care to people is why Democrats run for office.
Right.
Giving tax cuts to people, primarily to rich people, is why Republicans run for office. It is who they are. Now, if we're fair to them, they have a philosophy. It is a philosophy of smaller government, so they want to starve the government of tax revenue and trickle down economics, where if you give more money to rich people and corporations, that money will trickle down and raise in new jobs, investment, and higher wage people. That philosophy is wrong. There's no evidence it works.
There's a lot of evidence that it hasn't worked.
Yes. In fact,
every time it's happened.
Yes, they have tried it several times, and every time it's failed, and Democrats have had to come in and clean up the mess. But that is who they are. Second thing is, the Republican Party is primarily funded and led by billionaires. The Kochs, the Adelsons, hedge fund managers like Peter Singer on Wall Street, who provide – you know, if you want to run for president of the Republican Party, you need to get your own billionaire to fund your super PAC.
Right.
And those billionaires are not particularly happy with the way things are going because they have access to the internet. And they have not been contributing to Republican campaigns at the rate in which Republicans had hoped. And so one way to get more campaign donations is to give more money to your largest campaign donors. So there they go.
And this is not just, you know, us liberal podcast hosts. It's just making this accusation about the donors. Lindsey Graham said, we need to pass this bill for our donors so that our donors can raise money.
Yes.
Two Republican members of Congress, I think Chris Collins and someone else, also said the same thing. So we have multiple Republican politicians on the record saying that they need to pass this bill to please their donors.
Yes.
This is why we call it the Donor Relief Act.
Yes.
It is not. It's an actual – I can't even believe that they actually said that, but they said it.
I mean, points for transparency, I guess.
Points for transparency. Right. No, but I guess my question is, why was the bill, or did the bill have to be designed this poorly? And by that I mean, you know, neither you or I were big fans of the Bush tax cuts in the early 2000s. they were a disaster. They increased the deficit by $1 trillion. They didn't do anything that they were promised to do. They didn't create a bunch of jobs. We lost jobs throughout the 2000s when Bush was president. It was sluggish job growth, sluggish wage growth. So the tax cuts didn't work. But when they were passed, the Bush tax cuts were more popular than unpopular. And Bush administration and Republicans then could credibly say, yes, we're cutting taxes for the wealthy, but we're also cutting taxes for everyone else. And that's that. This bill, this is like, you know, huge tax cut for corporations, and they'd get an even bigger tax cut for moving their profits overseas to foreign countries because
many people have been calling for that.
America first, right? Repeal of the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act, which could increase the number of uninsured by 13 million and raise premiums 10%. Higher taxes for graduate students, higher costs for college students, $1.5 trillion to the deficit, more expensive than the Bush tax cuts. And then, you know, Marco Rubio sort of gave up the game yesterday when he said that tax cuts that add to the deficit are the first step, and then the second step is to close that deficit by cutting Social Security and Medicare. And by the way, you know, it's Thursday. They're debating the bill today. They're hoping to vote on it by the end of the day. None of the details of what's in this bill, or a lot of the details of what's in this bill, are still missing.
Yeah.
So, like, why is it this bad? Oh, and there's also, the New York Times had a great story on this. You sent it to me last night. Basically, I think it's called, it started as a tax cut, now it's going to reshape American life, which just shows how far beyond just simple economics this goes. There's, like, a provision in there that gives, like, legal rights to fetuses from the House. There's oil drilling in Alaska is in this bill to buy off Lisa Murkowski.
Just cause.
So what happened here?
we'll send that New York Times story out. I was reading it on the flight here last night, and I was kind of like visibly irritated by it and kind of like huffing upon it. I'm like furiously texting.
Yeah.
And I look over at the guy next to me, and he's watching interviews of Marco Rubio on CNBC on his iPhone. Not live, just like YouTube clips of it.
was it a Marco Rubio staff member?
I can't even imagine.
Was it Lovett making fun of him?
We found Marco Rubio's one delegate. So, look, this happened for a couple of reasons. One, the Republicans have no fucking idea how to govern. They just don't. They have been arsonists for 8 years, and now they're in charge of the firehouse, right? They don't know how to do this, right? So that's one. Two, they don't give a fuck about what they do as long as they do something.
That has been clear throughout this process.
And
that has been more clear, by the way, because a lot of people are asking, why isn't this like healthcare? With healthcare, they thought they needed to do something, but they weren't feeling the heat just yet.
Yeah.
It feels like on this one, it's like you don't pass this tax cut and you also didn't pass healthcare. What are you here for?
Yeah. And it is taking healthcare away from people is a core belief of Paul Ryan's.
Right.
But it is not a core belief of all Republicans. They don't run for, they didn't run for office because too many people have health care.
Right.
And which is why they were so afraid about the Affordable Care Act passing, because they don't agree with that way of providing health care.
Right.
They don't actually have an alternative to that way, but that is the philosophical concept. They did all run for smaller government and more tax cuts. And the reason
no Republican runs for office to increase taxes.
Yes.
They all run for office to tax since the beginning of time.
Yes. Thank you, Ronald Reagan.
Right.
But what is interesting about this is, and the Bush tax cut is an interesting example, because the Bush tax cut was just a tax cut. There was no reform. It was a temporary tax cut, which at the time was also a budget trick to, like they're doing here, to be able to pretend like it will have less of an impact on the deficit than it did. And the argument at the time was the United States had a surplus. I mean, this is hard to imagine, but the economy was so good in the 90s with a Democratic president that we had more money. We were bringing in more money than we were spending as a country. And Bush ran on the idea that it is your money, right? The government should have the money. You should have your money. So we're going to give that money back to you. That idea was a disaster because it ballooned the deficit that Barack Obama had to spend 8 years getting us out of. But what they've done here is so you can give a big tax cut. You can give a tax cut to people, just lower taxes, or you can reform the tax code where you go in there, you take out the loopholes that don't make sense.
Simplify
it, make it easier, which is a good – that is the right thing to do. We actually had a corporate tax reform plan that was deficit neutral, that lowered the rate only to 28% and paid for itself by getting rid of loopholes, right? This is neither tax reform nor a tax cut. It is a mix of the two so that they can say they did tax reform. So they carve out some things they don't like to push conservative policies. They lower the corporate rate, but they're unwilling to take on things like the carried interest loophole, which benefits hedge funds managers. They don't want to take that political heat to pay for it. So you're cutting corporate taxes and you're trying to pay for some of it by eliminating things that help individuals who are mostly Democrats. And so the whole thing is this Frankenstein amalgamation of terribleness. And it makes no policy sense and it makes no political sense other than the idea that we just have to do something.
I was going to say, I think so many of the worst parts of this bill came to be because they're so desperate to get to yes and to pass something. And someone in the New York Times piece said this, I think it was some lobbyist, said there's like a Christmas tree like aspect of this bill where you just keep adding things onto it in order to, so oil drilling in Alaska, yeah, absolutely. We need Lisa Murkowski's vote. A couple, you know, crazy things on abortion in the House, yeah, absolutely. We need a bunch of House conservatives to say yes to this. And so they just keep adding bad shit onto this bill so they can get to yes. And the difference with healthcare was this sort of puzzle where, you know, if you gave on one thing to get a vote, then you'd lose some other votes on something else. Here, you can just keep adding on and spending more money and adding to the deficit. And if you go past $1.5 trillion, which is the magic number where you can't go past because then you need 60 votes in the Senate, then you just add a bunch of accounting gimmicks on paper so that, you know, 10, 15 years from now, it looks like it balances out, but right now it doesn't. So between the accounting gimmicks and between adding anything necessary to get the votes that you need, it's going to look like a pretty awful bill.
Yeah. And that you raise a really important point comparing it to the Affordable Care Act, because no one will believe this, but the Affordable Care Act was paid for.
Yeah.
It did not add to the deficit. So if some senator came and said, I need an extra $10 million for community health centers, which benefit my state, if we were to give that to them, we got to go find $10 million to cut somewhere else to keep it at zero. So we had $0 to play with. The Republicans have $1.5 trillion to play with. And so they can give stuff to people all the time, and it doesn't
– very responsible.
Yeah, it's very responsible. I mean, it is the absolute worst possible way to govern. There's a story in the New York Times today about how Steve Mnuchin, producer of such films as Suicide Squad
– husband of Louise Lin.
Yes. King of photo ops. He has been telling everyone that the Treasury is working on an analysis that is going to show that not only will this not add 1.5 – oh, Mr. Deficit Hawk, are you concerned about $1.5 trillion deficit? Don't worry. We're working on this, and we actually think it's going to reduce the deficit by up to $1 trillion, which no one possibly believes. But so the New York Times finally contacted the people at the Treasury Department who do this analysis, and they're like, we have no idea what you're talking about. Like, they will lie, borrow, steal – and do anything to pass this bill.
Yeah. And look, again, Republicans like tax cuts. And so if that's what they want to pass, that's what they want to pass. But we should at least expect out of these Republicans, you know, adhering to the principles that they lay out, right? So with McCain and Corker and Flake, three people who will not be running for re-election again, who do not have to face voters, who do not have to face Breitbart or any of that. They don't have to worry about their donors and all that stuff. They're all going to vote for this thing. And, you know, they've all complained about the fact that it might increase the deficit. And yet – and it's going to increase the deficit by a lot. And yet here they are all voting for it. I'm not sure I understand why Flake and Corker and McCain went down this road, unless it's just pure tribalism, pure like – these are my colleagues, and I don't want to piss them off too much, and I sort of do like tax cuts, and yeah, it's going to increase the deficit, but maybe it'll pay for itself, and who cares? That's all I can get out of that.
Yeah, that's all I can think about it, and I can't really tell what the motivating factor is, because there's sort of two schools of thought on this for all the Republicans, because on paper, unpopular Congress passing a unpopular piece of legislation that raises taxes on the middle class that will be signed by an incredibly unpopular president is not – that's not a typical formula for electoral success. And so there's sort of – there's two theories. One is they have convinced themselves that if they do not pass something, this is the end of the Republican Party as we know it. Like this is
– yeah, I would disagree with that analysis.
But that is one. And the other one is the Republican Party is ending anyway, so we're doing legislative looting.
That's,
everything we possibly can.
This is Brian Boitler's point. It's just grab it on the way up.
Yeah.
We're all going to lose and just try to take what you can on the way out the door.
Billionaires running down the street with flat screens, TV, right out of the homes of the middle class. Like,
so the question is, what do we do? What happens next? A lot of people are saying, you know, is there time? Can I do something? It looks like, and by the time you hear this podcast, that, you know, I think this will pass the Senate. So what happens then? There's the House bill is different than the Senate bill, so there needs to be a conference committee. The conference committee is made up of members of the House and the Senate, all Republicans, and they'll work out the differences. But then both chambers have to vote for the bill again, have to pass the bill again. So, you know, we should still put pressure on all these members of Congress, particularly in the House, the members of the California delegation, the New Jersey delegation, the New York delegation, who, because of the repeal of the state and local property tax deduction, the state income and local income tax deduction, will be hit especially hard by the tax increases in this bill. And so I do think it's worth, you know, Ben Wickler emailed us this morning from Move On. If you're in D.C., if you're near D.C., there's going to be protests at the Capitol today, and they're going to keep protesting until this vote is passed. And then from now until, you know, Donald Trump signs this bill, people should be making a lot of noise about the effects on states like California and New York and New Jersey, because if all the Republicans in California, in New York and New Jersey, and a lot of the Republicans who voted against the Affordable Care Act in the House, and a lot of the Republicans in the House who didn't vote for this tax bill in the first place, all vote no, you know, you could still see it stopping. I don't think the chances are great, to be completely honest, but we might as well keep the pressure on. And we should keep the pressure on not just to stop this bill, but if it passes, I think we need to be incredibly noisy about this bill and let people know what's at stake here, because I think this could be the kiss of death for them in 2018. Yeah, what do you think about
that? That's exactly right. I mean, to your point, there will likely be two more votes after this. So it'll go to a conference committee. The House and Senate will have to vote again. And we should put pressure on those votes. And there are a significant difference between the House and the Senate bill, which could cause trouble.
Yeah.
And it's putting this sort of Rubik's Cube together is going to be hard. And so, you know, we don't have a great shot. We also didn't have a great shot at defeating the Affordable Care Act on several occasions, and we did.
Right.
So if you make noise, it can make a difference. And we have to make sure people know this happened and what's in it, because a lot of the impact –
I think it has to be our entire message.
Yes.
From now until 2018.
Right.
What happened in this tax bill, if it passes, and what they tried to do to the Affordable Care Act. I mean, I think this – it is incredible to me that the road to a Democratic House majority and possibly a Democratic Senate majority runs through some of the very districts – that will be hit hardest by these tax increases. Suburban swing districts with a lot of like middle to upper middle class taxpayers. These are not like Trump base voters who watch Fox all the time and no matter what happens, they're never going to change their mind. These are people like the people in Virginia who won the election for Ralph Northam and defeated Ed Gillespie. Suburbanites and people who own homes who are going to pay more taxes than this. And so like, I think it's crazy that they're doing this, because like all these Republicans that represent districts in California who are with people who are going to be hurt by this state and local property tax stuff, like it's crazy.
You know, we've all tweeted and talked about on this podcast the political ramifications of doing this, because it seems insane to us. And that, of course, requires some of the worst people on Twitter to respond and be like, well, you also thought Hillary was going to win.
Right.
And it's like, yeah. That did not happen. Hillary did not win. You got me. But that doesn't just because Trump won the Electoral College with the help of the Russians and Jim Comey and a bunch of other things does not mean that all the old rules of politics are gone. And if you want
look evidence, at Virginia.
Exactly.
Look at Virginia.
So I'm not going to make any prediction about what's going to happen, but there is reason to believe that – very strong reason to believe that an aggressive case about – the Republicans, who are literally taking health care away from people, charging students more, and raising tax on the middle class to pay for tax cuts for corporations and billionaires will be a winning message.
Virginia proves unequivocally that the rules of politics still apply. And if you look at the exit polls in Virginia, for all the discussion leading up until that election about MS-13 and immigration and Confederate statues, the number one issue for people who voted in Virginia was health care. And those voters went to Ralph Northam by even a larger margin than he won. And that was healthcare. So you combine healthcare with higher taxes on middle class people, you could have a lot. Deep red places, maybe not. But purple places, places that Hillary Clinton won, where there's a Republican sitting in the House and in the district, places like Arizona and Nevada, where we have senators, where we could flip Senate seats. This is, you know, we've got to keep fighting. Yeah. And so I think, you know, if we lose this, this is not, you know, people should not sit back and say, oh, we lost one, nothing's going. And same thing if, you know, if Doug Jones loses too. Like, you know, it could be a very tough December. That doesn't mean that we're down and out. There's going to be a lot of, you know, wins and losses on the way to a bigger win in 2018.
I mean, we've already lost the war on Christmas, I heard.
We've lost the war on Christmas. All right, let's talk about the deeply disturbed individual running our country. Donald Trump has been, I think, hitting the crazy pills pretty hard recently.
I think maybe he's not hitting the anti-crazy pills. Yeah.
To recap this week, I'm going to leave some out, but I'm going to try to
There's
remember.
There's not time.
He endorsed a child molester who hates gays and Muslims for the U.S. Senate. Yesterday, he shared fake racist anti-Muslim videos from a right-wing British bigot who's been charged with religious harassment and said that police should be able to shoot Muslims. That was something where the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom had to condemn Trump, and then Trump attacked her on Twitter. There's the scene in the British Parliament yesterday was... I mean, all these parliament members were just talking about, like, the racist, crazy president of the United States. I can't imagine anything more fucking embarrassing. Yesterday, he accused various NBC hosts and producers of sexual harassment and murder. He told people to boycott CNN. He attacked his own Justice Department and the FBI because of a Fox News story about how they're not participating in disgraced Congressman Devin Nunes' plan to obstruct their investigations of Donald Trump. There's a New York Times story this week about how he still believes that Barack Obama was not born in this country. He believes that the Access Hollywood tape with his voice on it isn't real. What the fuck?
I am not a medical professional. So I am
I know. It's totally, yeah, stipulated with all this.
Yeah,
we
so
don't,
I am not,
we know we're not supposed to diagnose Donald Trump.
I'm not diagnosing him of any sort of psychosis. So I'm not doing that. But what I will say is, if someone who was not the president of the United States said these things and behaved like this, you would be deeply concerned for that person's mental and emotional well-being.
Yeah.
And like it's like kind of funny in a gallows humor sort of way, but it is fucking scary because we have been there. We know how much power and influence the president has. We know the gravity of the decisions that they are supposed to make on a daily basis that affect people's lives, that affect national security. And like, there is no question, none at all, that Donald Trump is dangerously unfit for office.
Yeah.
Like, if he believes...
Which, by the way, you know, some of his base voters wouldn't say that, but I would say the vast majority of elected Republicans who are in Washington and a good portion who work in his administration would probably agree with that.
Yeah. I mean,
tremendous.
If he, like, there, like, people read that New York Times story about Trump thinking claiming the Access Hollywood tape is fake, and saying that Barack Obama's birth certificate is forged. And there are two ways of that. He's just lying. You know, when you guys talked about this on Monday, Lovett was saying that Trump's kind of like trying that out. And you guys were responding to a previous story.
Right.
The story that came out since then is much more evident that he kind of probably believes it.
Yeah.
And that's really fucking scary. Like, that is – like, there's no chance that Steve Mnuchin and Scott Pruitt and Betsy DeVos are getting the cabinet together to do the 25th Amendment. But they absolutely fucking should. Like, it is – dangerous things have not yet happened.
I always think about that.
And if this person is in charge of making those decisions, it's fucking scary. Put aside – the decades-long damage that Trump is doing to America standing in the world, to just the idea of decency in this country, to governing norms and rules, put that aside. That has happened. Like, we are going to spend much of the rest of our adult lives digging out of this. It's fucking scary. It just really is.
You were bringing up a point that Brian Beutler made yesterday. I think he's writing a Larniger piece about this. Which, you know, he sort of tried to answer the question, is Trump a pathological liar? Does he do this on purpose? Does he believe these things? And he was saying, you know, I'm sympathetic to the view and concern that Trump might be delusional. Clearly he's in decline, but Trump used to lie to everyone until he was put under oath. Talking about, you know, way back when during his one of his many lawsuits around his business, he was put under oath and did tell the truth. So the question is, does Trump just tell these lies because he knows he can get away with it? And if he were to sit down with Mueller and faced with the choice between lying and prison or impeachment, maybe then he'd start telling the truth. Like, does he know, does he have the capacity to know what's going on and tell the truth? And he's just realizing that he can get away with it, and which is why he's lying every day and believing in crazy conspiracies.
There, when I worked in a campaign a long time ago in South Dakota, there was a radio personality. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of a prominent radio personality in South Dakota. And he – and I had breakfast with him once because I was a little press secretary out, like, doing media outreach. And he spoke to me at breakfast exactly like he was on the air.
Uh-huh.
Like, he – his – I think at one point in time there was a – Donald Trump the person,
yeah,
and Donald Trump the persona. And he understood the value of Donald Trump the persona in terms of his celebrity, his fame, and his business. I think over time, those two things have merged into one. Will he be – is he smart enough to listen to his attorneys and be – and dance around questions from Bob Mueller? Hurry the fuck up, Bob Mueller. Under oath? Maybe. But I think he is – He has a capacity to create and live in an alternative reality.
Yeah, he does. I mean, did you see the Washington Post piece from last night about why, or it was yesterday? I read it last night.
Who knows?
Yeah.
The longest 96 hours of our lives.
Basically, yeah. It's a bunch of people, you know, in the administration, outside the administration, saying that he does these things because he feels that he is impervious to the consequences. So he lies. He says these crazy things. He is, you know, shares these tweets that are bigoted and racist.
Sexually assaults women.
And he does this because he has an entire array of propaganda outlets that defend him. His base applauds him because of the propaganda outlets, because of how they get their information. Republican leaders stand by and say nothing. They're all trying to get their tax cut done. So yesterday, heroes of the resistance, Jeff Flake and Bob Corker and all these people were like, yeah, those tweets were bad. Probably shouldn't have done those. But anyway, got to go past the tax cuts. And his aides aren't trying to control him. So I thought yesterday I was tweeting I always think back to that Axios piece when they talked about the Committee to Save America, which is, and look, we give Axios a hard time. It's not necessarily their fault. These people told them this in the White House. But the idea that these Republican leaders and Gary Cohn and Dina Powell and McMaster and all these people, they are stopping Trump from doing the worst, and they're all together trying to make sure that he doesn't do any damage. Not doing a great job, guys. Not doing a great job.
John Kelly, I'm not in charge of the tweets. That's not my... That is the thing, right?
It's so annoying to hear the tweets as if it's just like some silly social media thing.
Like he's Snapchatting his dog.
Their presidential statement. That's like, I'm not in control of the statements the president makes to represent the United States of America to the rest of the world. That's what he's saying.
When our closest ally in the world has to criticize.
Our closest ally in the world, led by a fairly conservative prime minister now, not some liberal Democrat.
Yeah, they should be friends.
Right, yeah.
I mean, then you have to pay attention to the tweets. Like, it's not – that is 80% of John Kelly's job. Like, great. I'm glad you've put in place a better paper process and Omarosa can't do bridal shoots in the White House anymore. But get in charge of the fucking phone, buddy.
In that Washington Post piece, Roger Stone, who is a disgraceful human being – did have an interesting comment where he said, Trump doesn't necessarily have a strategy. His instincts on the news cycle and how to tweak his enemies are extraordinary. And he believes that the only thing worse than being wrong is being boring. And that's what's driving him. And I thought to myself, I agree with everything Roger Stone just said. Yeah. I mean, it's so he does have, because everyone's like, oh, well, you can't call him dumb or whatever. No, he's dumb on a whole bunch of shit. Yeah. He does have instincts on how to troll people.
Yeah,
he's a very good troll, and he thinks that being boring is the worst thing. I mean, it's some insight into why he does what he does. Like, he knows that if he's not in the news, that if he's not saying anything, that if he's just sort of hanging around and being a normal president, then people might not tune into the show.
If you wanted to,
but that is a strategy that gets you from news cycle to news cycle.
Yeah.
The idea that he's playing, you know, he's got this long-term strategy that, every, you know, that he's playing chess is absurd.
Yeah.
But he does have a strategy to get him through day by day.
Yeah. It is, if you were to design the perfect person to maliciously and cynically gamify our current media environment, you would take someone who had deep experience with the New York tabloids and understood the power of reality television.
Right.
And that is Trump.
And the power of right-wing propaganda.
Yeah.
Right. And who happens to be a famous billionaire.
Yeah. And so Trump, Trump always knew, pre-being president, when he was just famous guy in New York, that his power and his money was related to his fame. And so he had to be in the paper. And if he wasn't in the gossip columns, if he wasn't being covered, then he was losing money. And so he said outrageous things, did outrageous things, went on Howard Stern and said horribly offensive things in order to keep himself in the news.
Right.
And that is so ingrained in his head. And that is his strategy. He wants to drive the conversation. And that was a good political strategy to at least beat, you know, almost two dozen qualified Republican presidential candidates and Ben Carson.
Yeah. And Hillary Clinton. Sort of.
Yeah. The Hillary Clinton one, it's a little iffy because she won the popular vote.
Right. I was going to say, sort of.
The Russia. So I.
Big caveat there. Yeah. So the other thing they said in that piece was that Mar-a-Lago stirs him up, that he gets craziest when he goes to Mar-a-Lago because he's free to roam around the club and just hear from the rich patrons there about, you know, whatever crazy thing they're hearing. And he watches more TV. And so he just starts tweeting, which just goes to like the to get this guy to even be somewhat normal, you have to have how many generals and officials around him staring over his shoulder. You have to have cameras. Like, you know, once you let him go, who knows what he'll do? This is the person who's president of the United States.
We know with first-hand experience how busy the job of the president is.
Yeah.
Meetings all day long, phone calls with leaders late into the night, briefings to read. I'm not saying Trump does all these things, but even if just coasting through the presidency is a really busy, stressful job. And so you finally get some time off. The world events are cooperating. You get out of Washington. You get with your family in a warm weather. And could you imagine your life choice being, sweet, I get to catch the Five live. I finally get to watch all that Fox News I'm missing.
Regular. My day is planned out. I got Fox and Friends in the morning. I got 18 holes of golf. I come back. It's time for the Five. I have some dinner.
Waters World.
I'll talk to some rich, crazy people at my club. And then at 9 p.m., I got Hannity, yes. And I'm going to bed. I got to be up early tomorrow. I got to be up early next day to do the tweets.
It's like football's on, basketball's on, binge watch Stranger Things. Like, do some normal shit.
He's nuts. So the other people he attacked this week were Chuck and Nancy. Remember that? Yeah, that was the whole thing. So he tweets at Pelosi and Schumer. They were supposed to meet to negotiate how to avoid a government shutdown. And he basically said in the tweet, I don't see a deal because they're weak on immigration and crime. And
it's just
like a crazy tweet. And so Pelosi and Schumer decide not to go to the meeting since Trump said he didn't see a deal. And so now we're in shutdown territory here. The government runs out of money on December 8th. They need to pass a bill to fund the government past December 8th. So the latest on this is Ryan McConnell and Trump are trying to put together a bill that would fund the government. Actually, yesterday the strategy was fund the government through January. This morning I saw they're going to fund it through December 22nd, basically just so they can get their tax cuts passed and not have a shutdown through Christmas. And then they will have another bill that funds it through January and then another bill. So they're doing this in increments. Question is, if Paul Ryan can get a bill through the House passed with only Republican votes for a short-term funding bill, which he can't get a long-term funding bill to keep the government open passed through the House because a lot of House conservatives would say, fuck you, I want deeper spending cuts, go find Democratic votes, which is their whole problem. But say that Ryan can tell these conservatives, hey, just give me a month. So then he gets the bill passed, goes to the Senate. Now the only way the bill can pass the Senate is if McConnell finds Democratic votes, because you do need 60 votes in the Senate. So what do Democrats do here? What demands do they make? What do they say?
My view is no Democrat should vote for a funding bill until we have passed the DREAM Act,
mm-hmm.
stabilization money for healthcare,
mm-hmm.
and have set in place some process to talk about how we're going to have a bipartisan process to fund the government going forward.
One more thing in there. I would say the children's health insurance program.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. And no votes, because I've been involved in a shutdown when the Republicans shut down the government when President Obama was president.
Was I there?
You were gone.
It was right when I left.
This was in the fall of 2013.
That's right. Because I remember I found myself one of my first television appearances, I found myself on Jake Tapper's show with Bill Kristol yelling about monuments and closed parks. And it was awful.
Yeah.
And I said, maybe cable is not for me.
Fuck it. I'll start my own media company.
Yelling at Bill Kristol about a fucking
monument.
And now
Bill Kristol's practically a friend of the pod.
There you go.
But the politics of shutdowns are about blame. Right? Who's going to get blamed for it? And the Republicans got blamed overwhelmingly for it because they're the ones who shut the government down. This is a unique situation. There have been a handful of government shutdowns in our history, and every time it's happened, there has been a president of one party and a Congress of another. The Republicans control all of government. It seems like Democrats should be able to ensure that Republicans get the blame. It also helps that Donald Trump is deeply unpopular. The Republican Congress and its leaders
are
more unpopular than Trump. Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are so unpopular, it is like possibly hard to understand. So this is a battle we can win, but they are in charge of the government. It is their job to fund it. And because they cannot muster enough votes on their own, they need Democrats. And Democrats should not be giving their votes away for free. This is a battle we can and should win.
Yeah, and I think Democrats should say funding the government means keeping the promises that the government has made.
Yes.
And it means funding all of the government's promises. That means funding the children's health insurance program that makes sure 9 million children in this country have health insurance. It means disaster relief for places that have been hit by a hurricane. It means that when Donald Trump and the Republican leaders said that they would not deport 800,000 young American immigrants, that you keep that promise. And so, no, we're not going to fund the government unless we fund the entire government and all the promises. And I think that they should. I mean, we've already had Durbin. Durbin said he's ready to, he's not going to vote for any government funding bill unless they pass the DREAM Act. Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, Bernie Sanders are there. I would imagine that most of the Democrats end up getting there. What do you think about some of the Democrats who are up in 2018 in these tough states? McCaskill, Donnelly, Heidi, Heitkamp.
Look, these people know their states better than I do. But one strategy I know that does not work is trying to split the difference between being with the Republicans and being with the Democrats.
Yeah, it never does.
And so fight hard, fight together, and win the battle.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's time. And look, Democrats have leverage. Now, whether they give in to 2 weeks of funding the government and then have the fight, or 3 weeks or 4 weeks, I don't know that that makes a huge difference, though Lovett and I were saying this yesterday on the live stream. The closer we get to the debt ceiling, then the harder it is to make these demands, because I don't think Democrats should fuck around with the debt ceiling. Because I think that that's when the global economy collapses, once you breach the debt ceiling. But I do think that Democrats need to have this fight. We have leverage. And we should use it.
We should have the debt ceiling discussion in a later pod. I agree with you, but I'm not sure the normal rules apply in abnormal times.
Yeah. Although we just talked about the crazy person who's running the government. And, some Republicans might have believed that no matter how much they push Barack Obama, he would not let us default on our debt and cause a global economic collapse. Donald Trump? Yeah, maybe.
No question. I just think we got to think about how to
do it. Yeah, we should think about it. Yeah. Okay. When we come back, we will talk to our old friend, Pete Souza, Obama's White House photographer.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
All right, we are very lucky today to have in studio the former chief official White House photographer and our good pal, Pete Souza. Pete, how's it going?
Pretty good, man. I'm seeing a lot of friends of the pod out there.
Really? Are they behaving or what?
They're pretty much behaving. There's some hissing going on, but for the most,
most part. Hissing.
Yeah, I know. He's lost that war.
Pete, you have a fantastic new book out, Obama, An Intimate Portrait, which I'll be buying for all my relatives this Christmas. If you start with some questions, because everyone doesn't know you as well as we do. You were a photographer for Ronald Reagan as well as Obama. How are both presidents different, and what has changed over time about being a White House photographer from when you were there in the Reagan years to the Obama years?
I mean, the role of the White House photographer hasn't really changed. Your still primary mission is to document the president for history. I mean, I did that with Reagan. I did that with President Obama. But, of course, back in the 80s, there was no such thing as digital cameras. Yeah. There was no such thing as the internet. And the pictures didn't get out there like they did with President Obama, where we had Flickr and Instagram and the WhiteHouse.gov and so on and so forth. One thing that's interesting, the similarities between the two presidents is – they're both fairly even, had that even keel disposition. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
With President Obama. Well, President Reagan was pretty much like that too.
Right.
Pete, tell us, you were with President Obama all 8 years in the White House, but your relationship with him goes back before that. Tell the listeners how you got to know President Obama and how that led to you being the White House photographer.
So he was elected into the Senate in 2004, and I happened to be working for the Chicago Tribune, based in their Washington bureau. So Jeff Zeleny, who was then a correspondent in the bureau, came up with the idea of kind of trying to follow the new senator for his first year. In that process, I got to know him pretty well, you know, professionally. Somewhere I have a picture of Jon Favreau in
shaved head
in his little cubbyhole office there, and Senator Obama standing over him dictating a speech.
I remember that picture.
Yeah.
That was from the Tribune. That was in the Tribune.
Yeah.
I remember that. So you became one of Obama's closest friends in the White House. Do you think that this is the type of job, being White House photographer, where a close relationship with the subject that you're photographing is important?
I wouldn't say I was one of his closest friends. I mean, I was.
He might.
You were. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was in his space every day. And
he
most,
enjoyed you being there, though.
Most of the time, it was as observer and photographer, and then you know, occasionally there was some interaction between us. I actually think it's valuable to have. I don't think it has to be a friendship, but I think you've got to have the respect, the mutual respect for each other, to be able to photograph in these very intimate situations, including the non-official situations. Like I did a lot of family photos in, you know, essentially private situations, and you really have to have the confidence of the president, and you know, to be able to get those kinds of moments.
Yeah. Do you go into events with a certain shot in mind that you want to get, or do you go into an event, take everything that you can, and then look later to figure out, you know, what you want to?
I wish it was that simple, John.
As someone who knows nothing about photography.
So there are some occasions when you're definitely going after a certain shot. So, for instance, the 50th anniversary, the march from Selma.
Right.
Where you're trying to get that bridge in the photo, right?
And you're thinking about that ahead of time.
Yeah, you're thinking about that ahead of time. Or let me see, think of another example is leaving the Oval Office for the last time. I knew which door he was going to leave. So I really thought about trying to make that a really good picture. And
you brought out a ladder, right?
I brought in a ladder because I wanted to get as wide a shot as I could from above to kind of show as much of the Oval Office as I possibly could. So occasionally it's like that. But most of the time it's taking in what's taking place and trying to figure out what kind of mood, what kind of emotion, what's the best way to tell the story of what's going on. It's not a lot of like hit or miss things. It's really trying to get a lot of hits. And the one advantage of being a seasoned photographer is I've been in a lot of different situations. So intuitively, I sort of know, what to look for.
You took one of the most famous photos, I think, in at least recent American history, which is the photo of the president's national security team on the night bin Laden was killed. Can you tell a little bit about the story of how you got that photo and how that day played out?
Sure. So I wasn't privy to the raid itself beforehand, but about a week before, Cindy Chang, who worked for John Brennan, and her office was next door to mine, came to me and said, "You need to be available next weekend." And I said, "Okay." And she said, "It's either going to be Saturday or Sunday." And when she said that, I knew what it meant. It meant there was some mission that was dependent on weather, right? That's she didn't say that to me, but I figured that out.
That's pretty smart.
So I knew something was going down big. I just didn't know exactly what it was.
That was a lot more intuitive and perceptive than us, which when we were working on the correspondence speech, and he was like, "Take out that joke with Osama bin Laden," and we were like, "Why? That's stupid."
Right. No, exactly. Friday or Saturday.
Saturday, yeah.
So, it turned out that it was Sunday, and Cindy had given me a heads up later in the week. "It's going to be Sunday," she said. And that's when I really knew, okay, this is a special ops mission. And it wasn't until the first meeting that day, it was on a Sunday around 1 o'clock, where the team gathered together. This is about 3 hours before the raid when I learned what it was. So then around, I forget the exact time, but sometime in the late afternoon, like around 4, is when the raid took place. And they set up in this small conference room across from the big situation room to monitor as it was happening. And everybody was jammed into this room. It was probably against the fire code to have that many people in the room. And I got stuck in a corner, and I couldn't really move because I had like 5 people basically around me. And then for 40 minutes, as they were watching this raid, I was photographing.
Was there any moment you wish you could have captured but didn't or couldn't?
You know, I've had several people ask me that, and, I always...
Including me on Wednesday night.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I could never come up with a good answer to that. But a couple of weeks ago, Reggie Love was in the audience. And when I said I couldn't really think of it, case and
he just yell out?
He yelled out.
Of course he did.
And he yelled out that I didn't get the picture when Coach K of Duke came to the White House because Duke had won a national championship and Reggie used to play for Coach K, that I didn't get the picture of Coach K, Reggie, and the president together.
That's a very, very un-Reggie response.
It's also worth noting, for those who don't know, that Reggie wrote a book largely about his relationship with three men, his father, Coach K, and Barack Obama, and I feel like that he really missed the cover shot to that book.
Exactly. I think that's what it was.
This is about Reggie's. So it was a question about Reggie's book.
Yeah. And so, Reggie never lets me forget this.
I know it's also probably annoying to hear the question, what's your favorite picture? Because you probably have a bunch. What are some of your all-time favorites?
Well, I mean, if you go to the back cover of the book, that's probably one of my favorites. It's a little Jacob Philadelphia. I think he was 4. Touching the head of the President of the United States because he had asked a question that his friends had told him that his haircut looked like the president's. And when he said that, the president bent over and Jacob touched his head. And I think it resonated with a lot of people. Part of it is you've got this 4-year-old kid who's touching the President of the United States who looks like him.
Yeah.
But it also tells you something about Barack Obama that, like, at the behest of a 4-year-old, he would bend over and let this kid touch his head? Yeah. I mean, you know, I think so. For those two reasons, that's kind of one of my favorites.
And that was, I think that was hung up in the White House
the whole time.
The whole time, right? It was one of the only.
It was up for a long time, and Jackie Combs of the New York Times noticed that all these other pictures are being rotated out, and this one stayed up, and she decided to write a story about the photo, and that's when it really got a lot of attention.
Yeah.
And then sometime in like in 2014, I was just like, all right, this has got to come down. So I took it down, and the next day I had three staff people individually come into my office pleading with me to put it back up, because when they were given West Wing tours to their family and friends at night, they'd love to stop in that photo and tell them the story. So,
did you put it back up?
I put it back up.
Yeah. People don't know this. One of my favorite parts about working in the White House is all of your pictures are turned into what we call jumbos, mm-hmm. bigger size pictures, and they're hung up all over the White House. And then you rotated them, once every couple weeks?
No, you know, every couple weeks we'd put in maybe 10 or 15 new ones.
And it was so cool. You'd come to work and all these new pictures would be up all over the White House.
Everyone would look and see if they made a jumbo for that rotation.
Yeah, you'd count them up.
Yeah, like, oh, I'm still powerful. I have influence. Was Levitt ever in a jumbo?
He was in a jumbo. We'll post it again on Twitter. There's a great jumbo of Lovett and Reggie Love.
Yeah, that we made that a jumbo.
Sitting in like a little mini train squished in on the National Park Store back in 2010 or 11. Yeah. So since leaving the White House, you've been posting pictures of Obama on Instagram that often correspond with news about Donald Trump. For example, yesterday when Trump attacked Muslims, you posted a picture of Obama shaking hands at a mosque. What are you hoping people will take away from your Instagram feed post White House life?
I think I'm kind of a funny guy. So, like, you know, I take great pride in trying to find just the right line to accompany my photograph.
Yeah.
And my wife the other day said to me, I didn't know you were this funny. And I was like, you just haven't paid attention.
Have you enjoyed being called you're an expert Trump troll now? That's
for the first 6 or 7 months that I was doing this, I had all these people wanting to interview me, and I just didn't do any interviews because I thought letting it stand for itself was more effective.
Yeah.
Now, one thing that happens when you're promoting a book is that everybody asks you about it. And so, I'm trying to figure out the best way to answer and still sort of not say anything.
Yeah.
That was pretty good.
Yeah, I think so.
So, Pete, you flew on Air Force One with Barack Obama more than any other civilian, right? So you did almost every trip. I think the only time I ever flew on Air Force One and you were not on the plane was on a return trip from Boston when the Red Sox were playing in the World Series, and you dropped off to go to the game, which is
totally understandable.
An excused absence, I believe, yes. Do you have a favorite trip in the probably millions of miles you've flown Air Force One?
That's a good question. Probably when we had like a really cool cultural stop. So, for instance, I forget if you guys were there, we went to Petra Jordan.
I was there for that. That was amazing. That was amazing. My favorite trip.
Right? Yeah. A place that I probably would never have thought to go, and it was just it was amazing. Climbing inside the pyramids.
Oh, that was cool.
Climbing up those rickety stairs. That was pretty cool. Going to Stonehenge. So it's those kind of things. I mean, as you know, Dan and John, a lot of these foreign trips, you're stuck inside some conference center, for some summit meeting.
Yeah, for hours,
days. Or you're going to, a presidential palace, and you don't really get to see the city that you're in. But like a few times on the places that I mentioned, you do get to see some really cool things. So those are the ones that stick in my mind.
Pete Souza, thank you so much for joining the pod. The book is Obama, An Intimate Portrait. Everyone go get a copy. It is an excellent Christmas present and just excellent nostalgia of the Obama administration.
Thanks for having me on, John.
Absolutely.
It. 5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
On the pod, we have the host of With Friends Like These, Anna Marie Cox. Anna, how are you?
I am good, but, well, I've been thinking about how to answer that question because, as you know, usually I'm fine in Trump-adjusted terms. Today, I am furious in Trump-adjusted terms, which I feel like is, like, extra furious.
We had a pretty angry pod today, too, actually. So far, we've covered the tax cut fight. Obviously, that made us angry. We did sort of a general area of discussion on Trump in decline, perhaps.
Mental decline?
No, we don't diagnose anyone.
No diagnoses.
But clearly there's something amiss.
Right. Yes.
And clearly he is a pathological liar and dangerously unfit for office, which he has reminded us of many, many, many times this week. So those are the two things we've had time to cover. What's on your mind? Let's keep going.
Well, I don't know if you guys have been following the news.
Try not to.
But there have been some men in positions of power who turn out to have been assholes.
I unfortunately have to ask which ones you're talking about. Now.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of them. I mean, there's a range of what kind of asshole they've been. Some of them appear to have been actual rapists. Matt Lauer.
Yeah.
For instance, the alleged actions he took include something that I don't know why it's not being described as rape in the headlines. Like, he had forcible sex with a woman in his office.
Yeah.
So that's on one end of the spectrum. And then, you know, we have these allegations about my senator, Al Franken, that have come out as well. And, you know, we are all talking about these things in the same breath, and I do want to acknowledge that these are different scales of awfulness, but there's awfulness out there and we're finally talking about it.
Yeah.
And I guess I want to ask you guys, mm-hmm. as guys, what do you think?
I think it's horrendous. I think it's disgusting. It's funny, I'm hesitating to say I'm surprised because obviously I follow all this on Twitter, and when a lot of men say they're surprised, a lot of women say, why are you surprised? Like, we're not surprised. We've been noticing this for years. And I guess I would say I've been very aware that there's obviously a culture of toxic masculinity out there and that a lot of men are pigs and do pretty awful things. But, you know, I've never, as far as I know, I've never worked with anyone who did what Matt Lauer did, who even did what Al Franken did, you know? And so it is sort of, every new headline about this is revolting, but it's also just, it is, I have to be honest, it is shocking to me.
Yeah. Dan, do you want to
say something? Yeah, sure.
I'm taking this in, and I actually, one of the reasons I'm asking you is I want to allow some space for you to express surprise. I don't think that women should be scolding men for expressing surprise. So, Dan, yeah, I mean, I mean, how about you?
I feel the same way about John. And as these things have come out and, like, you know, not naive about the idea of that sexual harassment takes place in the office, that there is just a general institutional level of sexism that affects the workplace and society writ large. But, you know, some of the things we are hearing about people we know, right? And people we have worked with, not closely in the same office, but, you know, who have covered White Houses or campaigns we've worked on or have been on the shows that they host. And, you know, the thing I've been wrestling with is why I am surprised by this, mm-hmm. right? And what, because I have spent much of my time since we started having this conversation a few weeks ago thinking back to the workplaces that I've worked in. And, you know, were there things that I missed that I, you know, either did not, was too naive to see, did not, just missed because I was dumb, or took to be normal, you know, thought things were how things were done at work. And I obviously can't think of anything along the lines of what Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer and Harvey Weinstein, some other people are accused of, but it obviously is happening. It's not just the hosts of morning shows and Hollywood executives. This is obviously happening in workplaces across the country at all levels, whether it's Congress to, you know, sports teams to Wall Street to, you know, like a local insurance office somewhere.
And service industries are actually, I mean, particularly rife with this. The hotel industry, the restaurant industry, I mean, you can imagine.
Right.
The kinds of abuses that go on there.
You know, and we're finding these things out about Matt Lauer and others because they are journalists and there are other journalists looking at them because they were powerful people and that's a story. Who are the people who are going to, what are we going to do about the places you're talking about where there's no one looking to see what's happening in, you know, at a local restaurant somewhere or a bar somewhere or like the insurance office? What, you know, it, the solution to this problem can't be entirely investigative. You know, investigative journalists are not going to root out all
right.
of the bad men. Mm-hmm. That's not a scalable solution to what is obviously a widespread and incredibly disturbing problem about male behavior in this country.
So I think, like I said, I sort of wanted to, it seems weird, but like a not scold for you specifically and men in general expressing surprise because, you know, patriarchy is invisible until it's not.
Yeah.
You know, and then once you see it, hopefully you can't unsee it.
That, I believe, is true. I don't know how many people it will be true for. I hope the vast majority. It is certainly something that I think, you know, like I was complaining yesterday that our collective memory is now, you know, about 2 minutes as a country.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this has now been going on long enough, just since the Weinstein story. Well, I mean, it didn't really start with Weinstein. It started with Trump and yeah. then Ailes and O'Reilly and then the Weinstein mm-hmm. story and everything that's happened. And it's happened at such high levels of so many different industries. It is my hope that this is something that we cannot unsee and that we do not unsee or turn away from. It does feel different this time.
Yeah. And I think what is happening for a lot of men who feel surprise, I feel like I need to be careful almost how to phrase it, is that you guys probably knew the statistics about rape and
yes.
assault, right?
Yeah.
Like, which is like 1 in 5 women are raped in their lifetime, 1 in 4 experience sexual assault. But those probably didn't have like an emotional truth for you.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, I read your excellent Esquire piece about Franken. And you talk about an incident that you had, not with Franken, but with someone else who is well known. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you remember, but you told me that story when we first met, like, years ago,
right.
when we knew each other. And I remember it because it stuck with me. And it stuck with me because I had not heard many stories like that before. And it was interesting because you said in the piece, you know, at the time you laughed it off and you tell that story almost laughingly as, what a creep. And when you told me that story, that's sort of what I thought too, like, what a creep that guy is.
Mm-hmm.
And it is interesting since this has happened. I look back on that and I've looked back on that story too and think like, well, I you know, I know you told it to me in sort of a laughing manner, but I was like, I wish I had taken that more seriously then, you know,
yeah.
Because...
Well, I think that women are reexamining their experiences too.
Yeah.
I think actually those numbers, 1 in 5, a woman being raped, and 1 in 4 for being assaulted, are actually greater. The assault especially. The technical definition of assault is unwanted touching, right? Unwanted sexual touching. I honestly believe there's not a woman alive that hasn't experienced some level of it. And I guess one of the things that I want to encourage people, you guys specifically, and just men, is like, just, you got to both talk to the women in your life and talk to each other about this, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you start asking, hopefully you'll start to understand, like, the threat of sexual violence shapes every woman's life.
Yeah.
It is something we think about almost every day. I went for a run yesterday, and I had to think about, well, is it going to be dusk when I go under that overpass or not? Right?
Yeah.
And I know you men also worry about, like, being robbed, but that's a different fear.
Yeah.
And it's also not a fear that's constantly reinforced by, like, this unwanted touching. Because what that unwanted touching and groping is a reminder that you could be a victim of mine. That is what that means. It is a show of power that is ultimately expressed in rape, even if it's never actually expressed to that woman that way. I want to tell a story, like, I remember the first time I realized that my life was going to be different and my life was going to be governed by avoiding getting raped, which sounds crazy to you guys maybe, but I was in high school. I read On the Road by Jack Kerouac, and like all good rebellious high school students, I was like totally inspired, and I wanted to like be out there and do that thing and like the freedom of being on the road. And I realized, oh, I can't do that. I can't travel. I can't go hitchhike across the country because I'll get raped. I remember crying about that. And that's just a truth. And I'm tearing up now. Like, I want to just, I hope this is starting to sink in for people, for men. I hope that it is.
Yeah.
I know that there's a subset of men also that have experienced this themselves, experienced sexual assault and rape themselves. And obviously, I think that for them, this moment is really important too, you know, because their lives have been shaped by it.
Well, it's certainly sunken in with me, and I know, you know, I have been talking to both women and men in my life about this, and I think it's true for a lot of people. You know, it's something that's, you know, when we talk about issues in politics, sometimes the challenge is it's a small world of people who pay attention to politics. But I think because this has happened throughout the entertainment industry, throughout the media industry, to so many recognizable people, I think this is a much larger conversation that people are having. At least I certainly hope so.
Yeah, I also want to tie it actually into everything else you've talked about today, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is that one of the reasons why we're having this conversation, one of the reasons why it's a hot topic, is that it's being minimized. Of sexual violence against women is being minimized in order to pass a tax bill.
Right.
Like, that is a thing that is happening. Like, I can't think of a better example for our politics right now, you know? And then, of course, there is the fact that we have someone who is a admitted sexual predator in office. And I say it to you guys all the time. I will never get tired of saying it. That's a daily reminder that women have less power.
It is.
And if we want to end like on a positive note, like, this is the moment. Like, we can't let this slip by.
And I also believe that we as Democrats need to call this out on our own side. And, you know, I think Conyers should not be in office. I think, especially after the stories today, that Franken shouldn't be in office. I do.
Yeah.
I just think it is crazy that in every industry where this has happened, the accused immediately resign, except for politics so far.
Yeah.
That is just, as people who care about politics and want people to believe in public service and believe in the possibilities of politics, we can't just sit here and have no accountability for these things.
I mean, it's a sad statement on American life today that this issue is being filtered through partisan and tribal filters, right?
Yeah.
And where it's like the revelations about Al Franken are an opportunity for Republicans and right-wing media types to say, to attack Democrats. It's an opportunity to bring back up the allegations against Bill Clinton and Bill Clinton's very inappropriate behavior. And when the victims of what has happened and what's happened across the country, it's not Republican or Democrat, right? And it's minimizing what should be the biggest, most important story in America by saying, when you read the pieces in, you know, in Washington publications that say, bad day for the Democrats' sexual assault problem. It's like, no, it's America's sexual assault
problem.
I know.
You
know, Donald Trump is a Republican. You know, these are liberal media figures, you know, or donors to Democrats like Harvey Weinstein. That's not the point. And the fact that we can't even take something that affects society in this way outside of the realm of politics is one of the reasons why we're struggling so much in the country right now.
I agree. And I worry about this moment a lot. I've said to you guys, you know, offline, I worry about a repeat of what happened with the Anita Hill experience, which is that there was a similar kind of awakening about the reality of sexual harassment in the workplace that was kindled actually by another big failure, right? Another, if you consider Clarence Thomas being appointed to Supreme Court a failure, what kind of do? There was this moment where a woman tried to get heard and wasn't heard, and that created a awakening among women. It was the Year of the Woman, 1992. And then Bill Clinton's, you know, issues came forward, and a lot of, you know, a lot of feminists found themselves defending him, and we kind of lost the thread a little bit. And I worry that's going to happen all over again. And I don't know, like, I mean, you guys are already prepared for your Twitter mentions to blow up, right? Like, when you say Al Franken should resign, that's going to happen.
Yeah.
But it,
well, it's bothered me, especially because I've, you know, of course I look at the Twitter mentions all the time and I look at the tweets all the time.
I've never seen mine.
If some people wanted to argue where they at least admit the facts of the case in the Franken situation and then say, no, he shouldn't resign, or yes, he should, like, I can deal with that argument. I have unfortunately seen too many people who are doing what so many Trump supporters do, which is say, like, she made it up, or the photo's not real, or it was Roger Stone, or this. And I'm like, guys, do not buy into the fucking conspiracies that they do. Like, just, we can't do this. If you want to argue that these are the facts of the case, but then you don't believe he should step down, that's fine. We can disagree about that, and we can have an argument about that. But at least accept the facts of the case here, you know?
Or as we say, like, at least believe the women's stories.
Right.
Right? Like, it's not so much the facts of the case. Because also, I mean, we can have a whole other conversation about whether the language we use around this and how sometimes I think we overly legalistic,
right? Yeah.
About it, like, this isn't a case. This, you know, it's not that Al Franken is guilty or innocent. It's, is he going to be accountable to his actions, and is he going to uphold the idea that women's experiences matter?
Right.
Like, I'm of the opinion that Al Franken, if I think he should resign, but I also don't think he needs to disappear from public life.
Yeah,
you know?
Which is what you said in the story. Yeah. In the
I mean, I think he could do a great service to men and women of this country by being someone who stays in public life and talks about this, and talks about this as the experience of someone who used to think this was funny and now realizes it's not. We need that person. We need people. We need men who are going to go ahead and take that role. Because if it's just about shaming someone out of public life, you know, this moment will also not end well.
Well, I totally agree with that. And that's what Dan was saying, too, which is like, you know, investigate. This is not like the role of investigative journalists to just root out every single one. Everyone publicly shame them and then we move on. That's not really the point of this.
Yeah.
So, OK, well, who's on the show this week? Let's do that transition.
Right. Well, the transition is actually, I'm going to have Lizzie O'Leary, who's. She's awesome. She's a. I think she's still in D.C., right? Like, so she and I are about the same age and kind of came up through D.C. journalism and on parallel paths. And she wrote a great piece for New York Magazine, the headline of which is, you know, what I used to shrug off horrifies me today, which I think is an experience that a lot of women are having right now. In the same way that men are looking back on their behavior and wondering about the things that they may have thought were innocent that weren't. A lot of women are like, wow, that thing that happened to me, that, like, you, like my story to you,
right?
Like, wow, that was sexual assault.
Yeah.
And I need to call it that. That is important that I call it that. So I'm going to talk to her about that. And then also talk to Adam Serwer. I actually don't know how to pronounce his last name, but he wrote that great piece about the nationalist delusion for The Atlantic, which I hope
such a good piece.
You guys read. So I'm going to talk about that.
That'll do it. That's an episode.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an episode. That's grappling with some of the biggest things that we talk about on the show. So Yeah, everyone tune in.
Everyone tune in. And also everyone should go check out your the bonus episode you did where you went to a Hillary Clinton book signing and you talked to Hillary supporters waiting in line. I thought that was a good listen.
I think that's really, actually, I'm really proud of that. And I want everyone to know that the episode description is a joke because I describe it in the same language that people are using to talk to Trump voters. Like I went out to investigate what they're really like and if they're ever, you know, how strong is their loyalty. Yeah. But it is, I think, actually it's allowing these people who do represent a majority of Americans to speak for themselves.
Excellent. Well, everyone go check that out. Thanks for joining us. I think this is the outro then.
Yeah. All right, outro.
Love it must be sleeping still because he's not in the studio.
Those are his only two forms of existence.
All righty. We will, we'll see you guys next week. Take care.
Bye, guys.
Take care.
About Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps, in line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.